Good morning. So last time we went through the stages in our textbook single cycle processor design. We looked at sort of some of the conventions our textbook used in their design. You may or may not end up using in your implementation. Saw that, well, we had two write ports to our register file. Our textbook said, oh, we'll always use the E1 for ALU results, things that we computed like by adding, and the M1 for values from memory. We saw that as far as values being computed, that we had this ALU, and well, the ALU obviously is needed for the sort of arithmetic instructions, but it also comes up a lot in at pretty much any instruction that needs to compute an address, besides the PC, of course. And we saw that generally under this processor design, we had a lot of values that were being computed and not used. And when we think about all the stages, well, there's some stages which are mostly irrelevant to instructions, like, you know, like some instructions don't use memory, some instructions don't write things back. That didn't mean we didn't have to worry at all about those stages because, well, we had wires going into components and they had some value on them. We need to make sure that was okay. So, like, for example, for write back, we need to make sure, oh, we need to set the register number to indicate don't write. And for memory, we need to make sure the memory read-write signal is set correctly, even if, you know, the instruction doesn't use the write back or memory stage. We also saw that we had a lot of special cases, most of which were about these instructions that used the stack. That the stack instructions actually were pretty inconvenient for us. We needed to have a special case so we could read or write the stack pointer, even though it wasn't mentioned in the instruction machine code. We needed to have a special case for when we were computing a new stack pointer but wanted to use the old one. We needed to also have a special case for our call instruction that, well, the return address is not something we had an easy way of getting without adding a new circuitry for it. We also saw one other thing, which is kind of a special case, and that's how our textbook dealt with IRMoveQ and RMoveQ. So our straightforward implementation, what we started with, is that we said, oh, IRMoveQ, send the constant to the register file. And that's not what our textbook decided to do. They said, oh, we have an ALU that's already connected to the register file. Let's save ourselves some circuits and just compute constant plus zero for IRMoveQ. And this kind of seems silly from the perspective of, wait, you know, aren't we doing extra work? But presumably the textbook author's thought is, well, that ALU is there and it's doing something regardless of whether it's useful. So we might as well just save some, you know, MUX wires by using it. So that's what our textbook decided to do. And we went through sort of this general idea that in our circuits, you know, we have all these MUXes to make decisions where we have conflicts between what one instruction wants to do and another, and thinking about how to run an instruction in this single cycle processor is just, well, what are all the MUXes doing for that instruction in order to connect the, you know, right values to the right places? So questions on things we covered last time. Okay. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the quiz questions based on things that are confusing people. So we're starting with quiz question 2. This is asking about saying, oh, pop in the encoding we have now is 2 bytes. We have 1 byte, that's our opcode, specifies that it's a pop. Another byte which has the register we're popping into. And there's actually only 2 half bytes that are important in this encoding. We have the B, which is the I code, that first 4 bits of that first byte, that indicate it's a pop and not like an IRMoveQ. And we have the array, the index of the register we're popping into. And our textbook authors, in just making the YD6 encoding, did some things to make it more convenient, which maybe are less useful as far as, you know, being compact. And so they use 2 bytes for this, even though the information we actually care about fits in 1 byte, and we could put it in 1 byte. And the question we were asking on the quiz was, well, what would that entail? And it would be more complicated because now we'd have to get a register index for part of the instruction that no other instruction uses. Which means we'd need to add new circuitry to not just get RA and RB, but to get to this new register index place and send it to the register file. And for the pop instruction, I think the biggest point of confusion is that pop, it reads from a register, but the register it reads from is the stack pointer. It doesn't care about this register index. So it reads from the stack pointer, it writes to the stack pointer and to RA. And a lot of people seem to want to send RA as a register we read, but we don't need to read it. We don't care what it is beforehand, we only need to send it. So questions on quiz question two with pop? Shorter encoding. Okay. So quiz question three was about timing. And I think the biggest point of confusion in this question was that, well, we learned that, oh, okay, writing things happens at the rising edge of the clock. Therefore, we write things all at the same time because they're triggered by one single event. Now, reading values doesn't work that way. When we're reading machine code, we have this instruction memory that reads machine code as soon as its input indicates where to read from. So once it gets the program counter value to read from, it can read the machine code. A register file works in the same way. Once it has the register index to read from, once that's stable, it can read that register value. But to get the register index to read from, well, it comes from the machine code, either directly or indirectly, because we're using the I code to select, you know, the stack pointer, for example. So that means that reading from the register file has to happen after we read the machine code, because we can't read a register until we know what register we're reading. Like, it's just not going to be physically possible. The writing does happen at the same time because it's triggered by this external event. The setup for the writing happens earlier, but the register file doesn't look at when does the destination and value change. It looks at when does the clock signal say it now it's time to use that destination and value. But reading, just it does actually say, oh, when is the index ready? When the index is ready, it starts reading it. Doesn't need some external signal to say that. Questions about our timing in question three? And question four was, we were saying, if we were implementing an immediate to memory move, so we're moving a constant into memory, and I think there's a big point of confusion. The question was asking about the value input called mem input. That is the thing we're writing to the memory, what's going to be stored, and that is the constant from the instruction. The value the ALU is computing is going to be the address we're writing to. We have to compute that because the instruction needed to add two values for it. And that goes into a different input, mem out. Questions on quiz question four? Okay, so let's talk about our circuit here. So here I have the overall circuit we ended up with last time, and we have a whole bunch of boxes here, and here, and here, 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 here. And I'd like to know when we're running add R8, R9, what input will be selected by each of these boxes. That's your job to figure it out. So we're adding our 8 and our 9. So we have on here, we have the address of the add queue. And we have RA is R8, RB is R9. That's what's on those wires. We can also infer, therefore, that coming out of the register file is the value of register 8 there. So my question is, what should all the boxes be? So I've listed them. We have this box before the PC. We have the box for DestM, for DestE. We have this box in front of the data input to the the value input to the data memory. We have these two muxes in front of the ALU. We have this mux in front of the address input to the data. Give you a minute to check with your neighbors, see if you agree. How should all these muxes be set to? Who would like some more time? I should have placed this battery closer to that. Yes. I can just hot spot. Okay, so let's start with the first, let's start with the PC mux, so by which I mean this one here. Okay, so let's start, who thinks it doesn't matter what we do with this? Okay, so everyone either shy or thinks it does matter. Okay, so who thinks we should choose the top input? The middle input, well, the bottom input. Okay, so we have good consensus for the bottom input. And the bottom input, well, we can look at where it comes from. It comes from the PC plus instruction length. So this would be the address of the instruction after add. And that is, in fact, what we want to fetch next. So that is, I believe, the right output, and it does matter. if we don't choose the right thing, we're not going to go to the instruction after the add max. We're going to go somewhere else. Okay, so let's next do desktop here. So who thinks this doesn't matter? Okay, who thinks we should choose the top input? The bottom input? Okay, so we have consensus there. We don't want to write using the memory value. How about Desti? Who thinks it doesn't matter? Thinks we should choose the top input? Thinks we should choose the middle input? The bottom input? Okay, we have good consensus here, so that's Z. We went to write to register 9. How about our data memory input? Who thinks it doesn't matter? Okay, who thinks we should choose the top input? The bottom input? Okay, so we have some split between doesn't matter and bottom input. And I would say that it's not going to matter because we're going to put in a 0 for right. So this sort of, this, you know, won't matter because we're not writing it. So there's going to be something there, but it doesn't matter really what we choose. Okay, and how about the ALU A input? Who thinks we should choose the top input? Okay, the middle input, bottom input. So we have pretty good consensus. We want the middle input, and that's going to be the value of register 8. We want to add the value of register 8 to something. We better put it into the register file. This is our, oh, sorry, not the register file, to the ALU. This is their only way of doing that. And how about our other ALU input? Who thinks we want the top one? Okay, so I think we have pretty good consensus there. This is our only way of getting the value of register 9. Presumably we're going to choose the top input for source. And finally, we have our mux for the data memory address input. Who thinks this doesn't matter? Okay, thinks we choose the top one, bottom. So most people say it doesn't matter. I would say, yeah, it probably doesn't matter because we're going to send something to the data memory, but we're not going to tell it to read, so it's not going to do anything. That's for our add. Some questions on this? So let's quickly do this for our move queue. Maybe a little more difficult. So this is our move queue, RA to D. RB. Okay, so let's start with our PC input. Who thinks we want the top input? Middle input? Bottom input? Okay, so we have consensus. The same as add, we want to get to the next instruction. There's nothing. What this instruction does, as far as for the PC goes, is the PC gets the current, address after the RA move queue. How about our dest m? Who thinks we want the top input? test down. Because we want the bottom input. Okay, so you have grid consensus on the bottom input. So this is a memory instruction, but if we write out what it does, it sets memory at D plus the value of register B to something. It doesn't actually write any, I should do this. Doesn't actually write any registers. So we're gonna want to select not to write with test M, even though this is memory. And similarly, we're gonna select not to write with test D. We're not writing any registers. It's not part of what the instruction does. Okay, how about our data memory input box here? Who thinks it doesn't matter? Okay, top input, bottom input. So we have most people select our bottom input. So our top input was our case for call. This is the address of the next instruction. We do want the address of the next instruction, but that's for our PC. We've handled that already. Instead, we want to move the value of RA into the memory. This is going to be the value of RA here, and we want to send that to the data memory. This is our only way of doing that. We better choose it. How about this first ALU input? Thinks we want the top input. Okay. Thinks we want the middle input. Thinks we want the bottom input. Thinks it doesn't matter. So most people want the top input. So the question is, what is our ALU supposed to be doing in this instruction? And we have something that we usually do with the ALU here, which is this computation of an address. So to do that computation of an address, we want to have the value of D and the value of RB. The value of D is this constant from the instruction, which is our top input. That's why we want that there. And then we need to get the value of RB into the ALU. It better be through the other input or else it's not going to happen. And it turns out that happily our top input to the other part of the ALU is here. Now, of course, if you were, you know, doing this yourself in HCL or us, you could change these boxes around so you could like have the D come in the B inputs by adding to that mux, but with the muxes we have here, the only way to get D into the ALU is to change that top mux. Select it from the top mux, and the only way to get RB is select it from the bottom mux. Okay, and finally, how about this mux here? Who should we have the input from the ALU selected? The input that comes from the register file. Okay, so most people want it from the ALU, and that's because it's making this thing happen. We better, if we don't use the ALU value there, it's not gonna matter for this instruction. Because we aren't, you know, we're, this value gets sent to the register file, but we've determined we're ignoring it. Okay, so questions about this whole process? Okay, so I have a bunch more examples of things you might go through, but we'll skip them for time, and because we seem pretty comfortable with them, we'll talk about our next topic, which is going to be about making circuits more efficient. But we're going to start by talking about something that isn't circuits. We're going to start by talking about doing laundry. So let's say I have a bunch of laundry to do. I have more than one load. I split it up into whites and colors so I don't make stain things. And the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to take the lights, gonna put them in the washer, wait for my washer to finish, move them from my washer to my dryer. My dryer is very fast, by the way, apparently. Wait for my dryer to finish. Then I'm going to fold them. Then I'm done with the lights. Now I can move on to the darks. So I'm going to take the darks, put them in the washer, move them from the washer to the dryer. And then I'm going to fold them. And finally, I've done my two loads of laundry. It's taken a couple hours, but that's okay. So is there a way I could do this more efficiently, which might be what almost anyone would do if they had two loads of laundry to do? Yeah. Yeah. So I have this time here. where I can use the washer. I can put the colors in the washer right away. I don't need to leave the washer empty for that entire amount of time. So I can end up with something more like this. And this is probably what most of you would do when doing laundry. It's intuitively more efficient. And we're talking about this because if we think of our circuits, the way our circuits often work is that if we think of like the instruction memory, it's reading a value, and then we're keeping that value there until we do all the operations for an instruction, and then only then are we reading the next instruction. That's how our processor works right now. It's more like the top diagram than the bottom diagram. We're going to want to get to the bottom diagram because intuitively, you know, that's a better way of doing things. Now, we're going to talk a bit about, well, how much better is this actually? Or is it actually better? Or why is it better? And one thing we're going to observe is that, well, you might say, okay, so I'm doing two loads of laundry at once, and actually three loads of laundry at once. If we look here, right, I'm using my washer, my dryer, and folding all at the same time. So it seems like I should be three times more efficient, right? But that's not actually what's happening. And there's a bit of wasted time. That ideally, you know, I'd be using my washer all the time, and I can't. Right? I'm not getting 100% efficiency out of things. And this picture is actually a little unrealistic. Here I'm saying my dryer is very fast. Most dryers probably take more than 30 minutes to like do a good job. So probably more realistic pictures like this. And there's a lot of time I can't really usefully use my washer. And a consequence of this is that if you were saying, do this laundry, this load of laundry as fast as possible, then I have done the wrong thing. Because if I measure how long it takes me to do one load of laundry, the time from when I start it to when I finish it, with this process, it takes a little over 2 hours. Whereas if I was doing the load of laundry the first way, the way it seems pretty clearly not a great idea, it's faster. So we call this time from start to finish, we're gonna call this the latency. So from when things start to when things finish. And when we're doing this idea of moving on to the next thing, you know, with our component, moving on, you know, so our first operation moves on to the next stage, then we start the next operation in the first stage, this idea of which we're gonna call pipelining. With pipelining, we have slowed things down as far as latency goes. That the time from which we start to when we finish is longer. It is less efficient in that sense. But this is obviously not actually the metric we care about. But if you were paying me, get this load of laundry done as fast as possible, doing it this way is not how to do that. But what we usually care about is not how long does it take me to do a load of laundry, it's how long does it take me to do all my loads of laundry. So we don't want to use this measurement, how long does it take from start to finish, this latency measurement. Instead, we want to use a measurement we'll call throughput. And this is going to be how much stuff do we finish per unit time. And one way we can measure that is we can look at, once we get things started, how long is it between when we finish things? So this timeline, it's a little less than an hour, which means that we can say we end up completing 1.2 loads per hour. And the way this process works is the dryer is my bottleneck here. That everything I'm doing after the dryer, the folding, I can do that faster than the dryer works, but it doesn't matter. I'm only doing it as fast as the dryer will get me close to fold. And the washing, I can do the washing a lot faster than the dryer works, but it's not useful for me to start the sheets earlier if I'm not going to have a place to put them. So I'm only running the washer as fast as the dryer will go. And this means that sort of if we look anywhere on this process, everything is happening at the same speed. So if I measure the time between when I finish loads, that's going to be the same as if I measure the time between when I start loads. They're both going to be measuring the same number, and it's going to be sort of my overall efficiency number, my throughput, how much stuff per unit time I'm doing. And this is generally the number we care about with laundry, that I don't care how long it takes me to do each of my three loads of laundry, I care how long it takes me to do all of them collectively. And the same is true with our processors. I don't care how long it takes to run the add instruction, I care how long it takes to run my program, which has thousands of instructions. I care how long all those thousands of instructions take. So if each instruction takes longer, but we're doing parts of them at the same time, so the thousand instructions are faster, I'm happy. So we have this pipelining idea. Let's apply it to our circuits instead of our laundry, right? We have this applied to laundry, let's apply it to circuits, and I'm gonna have a simple running example for today, which is gonna be doing a multiplication times three in a stupid way. I'm gonna use two adders. Why this is the stupid way? Because you might realize, oh, we could shift over, and that would be a lot more efficient. But we're doing it in a stupid way for illustration purposes. By multiplying times three by taking our input A, adding it to itself to get 2 times A, then adding 2 times A to A to get 3 times A. And let's say these adders take about 50 picoseconds from when we have their inputs to when they produce a result. So our timeline might look like this. We input 7, and our first adder is working once it has that 7 value for about 50 picoseconds, and then it has a stable output of 14. Once we have a stable output of 14, we're going to take 14 and 7, and the second adder is going to be able to work to produce a stable output of 21, and so this is going to take 100 picoseconds to actually produce its results. So we have 100 picoseconds latency in our throughput. Well, we get one result every 100 picoseconds. That's our interval. So we have 10 results per nanosecond as our throughput. So questions about sort of my proposed timing here? And what we'd like to say is, well, we have the same situation we have with our washer, that we have this time here when it seems like this first adder isn't doing anything. And we'd like to just start the next add right away so we can just go on and hopefully have things be about twice as fast. So we're going from a timeline like this. We input 7. We got the 14 come out 50 picoseconds later, and then we get our final result of 21, and then we input the next value, so we're getting one result every 100 picoseconds. That's our old system, and we'd like to end up with something more like this, where we input a new value about every 50 picoseconds, a little longer probably, and you know, we start doing the next times 3 operation before the prior one is finished, when the prior one's doing the second step, the second add. Sort of questions about the timeline we're looking for here. Okay, so let's do that. And a problem we're gonna have is that we need to add some registers. Why do we need to add some registers? Well, I told you that this first adder isn't doing anything here, but that's not entirely true. It's holding a value for us, that we need this here to be 14 and to be stable, so our second adder has 14 sitting here. And the only way that's happening is our first adder is holding that value for us. But if we want the first adder to move on to something else, we need to put that value somewhere else. We can't just have it be held going from the output of the adder. So the way we're going to do that is we're going to add a register to hold that value. And this register will be responsible for holding the values for, you know, the next stage, while the thing before it is computing a new thing. And similarly, we want to have a register here because Right now, when we're inputting 7, this wire here is holding 7 for the entire computation, but we want to have that be a value from the prior input in our new design. So we add a register here along with it. So notice that between our two steps, we have registers holding the inputs from one step to the next. And this is a pattern we'll use to implement pipelining in our circuits, this idea of going from one stage to the next, that will take the outputs of one stage, put them in registers, and by putting them in registers, this allows that stage to move on to something else, but we still have the values that computed. We can still use them in the next stage while we're computing something else. And this is stuff we have to add to our circuit to do this pipelining. You know, this one stage, then the next stage, while the prior stage is doing the next operation. So with this, the timeline we'd end up with, and I guess I should note some labels here. So I've labeled these sort of times as when the value will come out. So at time 0, like we'll have a value coming out here, and we'll have the value that will come out at time 1 here and here, which is why this is labeled with parentheses t plus 1. That's indicating when does this result come out that we have this intermediate value for. And I'm doing that because we have, you know, we're calling it A in the original circuit. Now we have sort of 3 different versions of A to talk about. And I've also added registers before and after because the assumption is that, well, if we're using this in a circuit that does this, probably we have some prior stage that we need to, is going to be computing something while we're computing something, so we need to hold a value, and same thing afterwards. So with this, sort of the timeline we'd expect is we input 7 initially here, and that means that we're adding 7 and 7 to get 14, and also putting 7 in here. And then we'll have a rising edge of the clock. So we have, this is our clock signal. So we have a rising edge there and a rising edge there. So we have our first rising edge of the clock. And what that's going to do is we're going to copy this 14 here to the output there. And we're going to copy this 7 here to the output there, because what the registers do on the rising edges is they copy their inputs to their outputs. And also, we're going to have a 17 that was sitting on the other side of our input register be copied that rising edge. So we're going to end up computing 17 plus 17 is 34. And we're going to pass the 17 here, and then we're going to have another rising edge where the 17 gets copied over here, and this 34 gets copied over here. And also while that happens, we'll have copied over the 21 that was sitting over here, sitting on the other outer to our results. And I'll just mark things. So I'm showing our green time is here, is basically here, and our blue time is after this next rising edge. So it's going to advance, so each rising edge is going to advance through each of the registers all in sync, lockstep, to move on to the next step for every operation. And so we have a whole bunch of adds in progress, one behind the other in this circuit. So questions about sort of our overall operation? The circuit with pipelines, yes.
So sorry for misunderstanding this, but on that, could you explain like how adding the registers cuts down on latency?
Question, how does adding the registers cut down on latency? It does not. But it's gonna improve throughput, but it is in fact gonna hurt latency. So let's talk about latency a bit, since your question is about latency. So sort of ideally what we'd want is that if this adder took 50 picoseconds, that we'd end up with, this would be 50 picoseconds here, and we have 50 picoseconds here. So whereas previously we took 100 picoseconds to get one result, now once this gets started, we should take 100 picoseconds to get two results. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Answer your question? So that's where our improvement would be in throughput, not latency. So far, with what I showed you, it seems like, the latency stays basically the same. But that's not going to be the case. The reason that's not going to be the case is because in saying, it takes 50 picoseconds to do each ad, I'm kind of assuming the registers don't take a significant amount of time. And registers are efficient, but they're not perfect. They're physical things. They take time to do things. And there are kind of two issues with how the registers take time. So far when I've talked about registers, I'm acting as if, we have this clock signal, it has a rising edge, which is an instant in time at which the register reads a new value. But the register can't physically do that. And there's some tolerances it has as far as acting appropriately. There's some amount of time before that rising edge during which the input to the register needs to stay the same, or else the register will not be able to stably read the right value. And there's some amount of time afterwards where the register is changing its output. It can't instantaneously change from a 1 to a 0. It's just not physically possible. There's some small amount of time afterwards. And we'll call the sum of these times the register delay. So this is the amount of time the registers need to do their work. We're going to need to account for that in thinking about how fast our circuits are in terms of both latency and throughput. And this is just that we have this physical limitation of our registers that, they can't act instantaneously. So adding more registers is, in fact, going to make things slower. The hope is that, that's going to be offset by the fact we're doing more things at a time. Some questions on register delay? Okay, so I told you sort of ideal would be 50 picoseconds if the ads take 50 picoseconds. Let's say we have to deal with register delay. Let's say our register delay is 10 picoseconds. So I'm indicating on this diagram that we have 10 picoseconds for this, 50 picoseconds for this adder, 10 picoseconds for this. And what we're going to want to do is, we have a clock cycle that we can set. There's one clock cycle, right? And we choose how long the time is between these rising edges. And we can set that to whatever time we want, but we need to make it long enough that the register has time to do its work and the adder has time to do its work. And our goal for performance is going to be to set the minimum time for that cycle that we can get away with without breaking things. So what is that minimum time? Give you a few minutes, check with your neighbors. So we need to account for that we need to do the add and have the registers do their thing. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A 50 picoseconds. B, 60 picoseconds. Cool. C, 65. D, 70. Okay. E, 130. How about something else? Okay, so we have a split between mostly B and D. And so, yes, the question here is like, well, in any clock cycle, we have two registers involved. How does that work? And so there's a bunch of ways you can think about this. So a way I like thinking about it is, remember, our register delay was time around sort of both sides of this rising edge, right? We had a little bit of time around either side of the rising edge. And I want to measure the clock cycle time. So one way I can measure that is I can say I can measure the time it takes to go through one register and then get to the other. And if I do that, I'm measuring the time from just before the beginning of this register delay to the beginning of the next one. And that's the same as our time between rising edges. I've just offset the place I'm measuring a little bit. Another way we can look at it is I can say, oh, you know, I want to measure sort of half the register delay of the registers before and half after. You know, so I'm kind of like measuring between here from the middle, in which case I'm accounting for half the register delay before, half the register delay after, and the stuff in between, and that's still a cycle. That's, you know, that's another way I can think about it. And I could also think about, oh, I'm going to measure from the time after the previous register delay to after the next one, and that's also a cycle. These are just all measuring the same amount of time from rising edge to rising edge, but sometimes I'm measuring it kind of offset a little bit. But it's going to be the same amount of time either way. So I only include one instance of the register delay when I'm measuring the cycle time. So I get 60 picoseconds. Some questions on how I figure that out, this idea of how our register delays sit in our clock cycle? Okay. So I have our cycle time. Yes, sorry. The question, out of the three lines I drew, which one ended up being more accurate? If our registers are the same on either end, they're all equivalent. They're all exactly the same, measuring the same thing. Because they're just measuring, they're measuring this clock cycle with different offsets. If our registers had different delays, then we'd actually need to know about what portions of those registers' delays are from the time needed before the rising edge and the time needed after. In this class, we're not going to deal with that detail, but in a real, quote-unquote, electrical engineering class, you might. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we have that our clock cycle is 60 picoseconds, and that means every 60 picoseconds, we get a new result. So our throughput is one output every 60 picoseconds, or 16 billion operations per second with some rounding. Okay. So, and this is less good than sort of our ideal, which would have been 20 billion operations a second if we didn't have to worry about the register delay. But we do. Registers are going to take some amount of time. Okay, so I made our calculations a bunch faster by sort of adding these registers and dividing this up into stages. And it's faster in the sense that I'm getting more done per unit time. It's not faster in the sense that I'm doing each individual operation faster. And a question we might have is, can we just keep doing this? So let's add more stages. Let's just divide the ads in half and like store their intermediate results. So we could do them in two pieces. Yeah, there's some partial results, hopefully. And you know, we end up with something like this, where we've divided the ad, each ad into two 25 picosecond pieces. And we have a register in the middle. And this is an attractive idea because we should be able to just keep making things faster. So there's two issues we're going to talk about with this. So one is, like, what's the limit to how much faster this could get? And the other is, well, can we actually do this? The answer is going to be kind of. There's some practical issues we're going to talk about that make this idea of split up the ads in half maybe not work out so great. But let's say we could split up these ads in half. Question is, what is our throughput after we do that? This is an operations per unit time. So we split the ads in half, so we have a 25 picosecond half, 25 picosecond half, and we store the results in a pipeline register between one of these registers, just pass from one step to the next. Who'd like some more time? Okay, who thinks A? B? C? D? Okay, so we have good consensus that it's C. We didn't try to account for half a pipeline delay only, or two. And that is indeed what I get. Okay, so this is faster than it was before. This is now 28 billion from 16. And the question we have is, well, can we just keep doing this? And, well, if we think about what happens, well, we're getting closer and closer to the register delay, and we're never getting rid of the register delay. So eventually, our cycle time is going to be dominated by that register delay, and that's going to determine how fast we can compute things. Like, the best we can do is we can get one thing done every register delay. And so if we sort of plot out sort of, this is the time for completion, so this is sort of the inverse throughput, this is the amount of time per unit work, and this sort of goes asymptotically closer and closer to the register delay, and we can see that when we added our first your sort of set of steps, we had like, you know, almost a 2x speed up. We divided from one to into halves. But as we're adding more and more stages, we don't actually get that much better. We're getting these very tiny returns. You know, and we could also plot this in terms of what the throughput looks like. So this is operations per unit time. And again, we're approaching this asymptote, which is the maximum rate at which register updates can happen, which is, in this case, with 10 picosecond register delay, 100 per nanosecond. So we can get closer and closer to that over time, but we're never going to do better than that, and it's going to be harder and harder to get closer to that. Now, this is with sort of assuming this ideal thing where we can split up our logic into arbitrarily sized pieces. But a problem is that, well, that's not always going to be possible. So let's think about what happens when it's not quite possible. We can't actually divide it up into equally sized pieces. So for example, let's say that I can't divide up the second adder into two equally sized pieces. I instead have to divide it up into a 30 picosecond piece and a 20 picosecond piece. Right? Just couldn't quite do it perfectly just because of how the ad worked internally. It didn't actually work out that way. So my question is, what is our throughput now? Thank you. do. Who likes more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E? Okay, so you have pretty good consensus on D, which is the answer I get. So remember our original example of laundry, that if the dryer was really slow, everyone had to wait for the dryer. The stages before have to wait because even if though they can produce results faster, they can't be used. So they're going to have to just slow down to stay in pace with the slower stages. And the stages after, well, they can produce results faster, but they're not going to have values to compute on faster. So we're going to end up being as slow as our slowest stage, and that's going to end up being this 30 picoseconds plus a register delay, so 40 picoseconds total time for our cycle time, which means we're going to get one result every 40 picoseconds because we couldn't split up this one adder even. And this sort of problem is going to happen all the time when we try to apply this pipelining idea, this idea of splitting things up into these stages, to real circuits, is that we're not going to be able to perfectly split it up evenly. And in fact, this is even very optimistic here. I'm assuming that I take something that's 50 picoseconds and I at least split it up into two pieces that add up to 50 picoseconds. Often, we'll end up with some sort of scenario like where I have 100 picoseconds of stuff and I like split it up into a 60 picosecond and a 45 picosecond part because I had a little overlap that I got rid of. You know, so now the total time for the stages is a little slower. It doesn't mean it's not worth doing, but we aren't getting close to that sort of ideal performance improvement. We're getting less than sort of what the ideal is. So in this case, with this imperfect splitting, I'm still 25 billion versus 16 billion originally. I've still got a bunch of improvement. It's just not nearly the ideal improvement, and it means that as we add more and more stages, we're going to have sort of less and less benefit in a more extreme way. So questions about these diminishing returns? Yes. So question, in determining throughput, do I look for two registers with the longest path between them? Yes, that is exactly what we'll look for. things. I guess I should say, to be more general, two registers or other things that like store data that are triggered by the clock cycle, that clock cycle or affected by the clock cycle. Okay, so we've talked about sort of gig pipelining and sort of very simple circuits. We're going to now apply it to our processor. And at this point, our stages that our textbook made are going to become real things. So right now, we have the single cycle processor where the stages are a conceptual order. And we learn that this conceptual order isn't really the order things happen. That, like, we read the register file once we have the values from the instruction, yes, but, like, all these writes happen at the end of the cycle because they're triggered by that rising edge. And these reads sort of are as values are available. There's nothing actually like enforcing that they happen one step after another. Now we're going to change that because we're going to make these stages with these registers between them, doing this pipelining idea, this sort of assembly line idea. And now we're going to use the stages that way. But before we do that, we're going to change these stages a little bit. So this is the stages we had written down before. And these aren't all going to work. And we're going to have a change where I've combined the fetch and PC update stages together. And you might say, wait a moment. When I'm thinking of like doing instructions by hand, like I fetch the instruction, I do the register reads. The last thing I want to worry about in dealing with the instruction is what do I run next? Like, why are we moving this all the way up to the top of the list? And the reason is because we need to have another instruction to run right afterwards. Once we're moving on to the decode stage, to reading the register file, we want to be fetching the next instruction, which means we better know where the next instruction is already. So that's why we're going to do that right away. Now, another problem you might say is, well, that makes sense. We need to get the rest of the structure right away, but we can't do that. Like, if I have a return, I need to get the instruction from the data memory. That's not done yet. We haven't gotten there. If I have a conditional jump, I need to figure out the condition codes. That's not done yet. And yes, that's a problem. And we're going to ignore that problem for now. We'll fix it later. But it is a problem, and we're going to have to do something about it. And the thing we do about it is going to make our processor slow. But for right now, we're going to ignore that problem, and we'll fix it later. So let's look at what these stages look like, sort of more concretely, with our processor that just does adds we looked at earlier. And I'm going to highlight where each of the stages are. So our fetch and PC update, this is our fetch. We get our instruction memory. And our PC update for add is just adding to get to the next instruction after the add instruction is machine memory. Our decode is reading the register values. Our execute is adding them together. And our write back is storing them. I don't have a memory stage because if we're only executing adds, we don't use the data memory at all. So I'm just not drawing it. So I'm going to want to turn this into a pipeline processor, one where we do one stage, then the next, while we're doing the next instruction's first stage. And there's one thing I want to fix here, and that's that, well, when we were thinking about all our pipeline examples before, I got some values from the first step, and I passed all those values on to the next step. And our current circuit isn't quite drawn that way. We have a signal here, which goes from fetch to write back. And that means that write back's inputs are coming from fetch and from execute. And when this is running as sort of a pipeline, we're going to have one instruction in execute and a completely different instruction that was fetched later in fetch. So these are going to be two different values from different instructions. And that's not very good. We want to have the values from each instruction all together. So to fix that, I'm going to redraw this signal like so. So it goes from one stage to the next, to the next, to the next. So I'm going to have this rule I follow that values always go from fetch to decode, from decode to execute, and so on. I always go from one stage to the following stage. I never skip steps. you know, because I want to make sure all the values for an instruction are together. I don't want to split them up into separate chunks that are sent differently. They all get sent together. And once I've done this, I can now add registers between the stages. And these registers are now going to store the values for a single instruction. So our fetch is going to be working on an instruction while our decode has the values that were previously fetched in these registers here. And we're going to be adding values for an instruction while our decode is reading the registers for the next instruction and so on. So these registers are going to hold the values that each stage is working on. So the registers before decode are going to hold the registers we're reading while we're figuring out what registers to read next. Our registers in front of execute are going to hold the registers we're adding. Sorry, hold the register values we're adding while we're reading the registers we're going to add next. So, and we have these bunches of registers. I'm going to divide these up into what I'll call register banks. And I'm going to name them based on the stages they're between. So I'll have the fetch decode registers are between the fetch stage and the decode stage. The decode execute registers are between the decode stage and the execute stage. And because we have no memory stage, we also have execute write back registers between execute and write back, because there's no memory step in this processor at all. And if we're thinking of this naming, I can also say that the PC register is between fetch and fetch, which is a special case where, unlike all the other register sets, we're passing a value from one instruction to a different instruction, whereas all the other registers were just taking one instruction's values, passing them to the next stage. But as far as the PC is where we learn from the previous instruction what instruction we want to run next. Some questions about the registers I've set up here? Okay, so let's look at how this might work with some instructions. So let's say we're running these two add queue instructions. And we start out by fetching the first instruction. So what's going to happen is that we're going to have, coming out of our PC, we're going to have the address of the first instruction, which means we're going to get the machine code for it here, which means we're going to have 8 and 9 sitting on the inputs to those two fetch decode registers. And we're also going to have the address of the next instruction sitting on the input to the PC. Then we're going to have a rising edge of the clock, and we're going to end up having 8 and 9 being output by the fetch decode registers, while the address of the second instruction is now output by the PC register. Our new input to the PC register is going to be the address of whatever the third instruction is, which we don't have listed. And our decode execute registers, well, they're getting their inputs from the register file, which is going to be reading the value of R8 and R9. And we also are passing 9 up here. Questions? What's going on? So I've shown you, I didn't show the values that are prepared as the inputs to fetch decode. Our fetch stage is also, our decode stage is preparing the values of R8 and R9 to add, while our fetch stage is now preparing registers 10 and 11 as the next ones we want to read. Some questions? So we have, note that we have sort of our first instructions here. Our second instruction is behind it. And that's sort of the pattern we're going to have. So after we have a rising edge of a clock, we're going to have our first instruction is going to be an execute. And our second instruction is going to be in decode. So we're going to be reading registers 10 and 11 while we're adding R8 and R9. And we're going to get the actual sum of R8 and R9 as input to our write-back feeding registers along with register 9 while we get the values of our 10 and our 11 as the inputs to the code execute. The next rising edge of the clock will move to the add of 10 and 11 while we're storing the value of R8 plus R9. Some questions on what happens here? Yes?
Would it still work if it was add Q R8 R9 and then add Q R9 R11?
Question is, let's say we had, so in the example here, we have different registers for the two instructions. Let's say they had some of the same registers. Would it still work? No. And that is a problem we will talk about dealing with later. But indeed, it would not work. Yes?
What's the latency of each instruction?
Question, what's the latency of each instruction? So to actually compute the latency, we need to know like how fast the instruction memory is, how fast the register file is, and so on, which we'll talk about like what we do with particular numbers later. It's going to be a bit higher, possibly a lot higher, than the original processor, because we have the two things going on. So one is that we have extra register delays. We have to go through more registers to execute an instruction. Previously, like only the PC really mattered as far as things that are in the register file. Now, you know, we have extra register delays. The other issue is that probably the speed of the instruction memory and the register file for reading and the ALU and the register file for writing are not all the same, right? So we have that uneven time for each of the stages. And depending on how much slower one of them is, we could have much slower performance potentially than the original, as far as latency goes. Throughput, though, it's gonna be better. And how much better also depends on the same factors. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so if we think of how this works, another way we can view this is sort of a timeline where I've written out the values the registers would be outputting. So initially, we're reading, say, address 0, where this first instruction is. That means that after the next rising edge, we're going to store 8 and 9 in these fetch to decode registers. And while we have 8 and 9 in those fetch to decode registers, so we're reading registers 8 and 9, we're going to fetch instruction with address 2, which is going to be add R10 and R11. Then we're going to have another rising edge. We're going to have the values of R8 and R9 and register 9 in these decode to execute registers while we're reading R10 and R11 and fetching the instruction with address 4. And a way we can think of this is that in our timeline, each instruction goes from one stage to the next. We can kind of follow them through these traces of register values. So our first add goes through all the stages one after the other, and behind it is our second add, and so on. So questions, this operation? Yes?
What if, after the first instruction, the next instruction also uses R9?
Question, what if after the first instruction, the next instruction also uses R9? We would have a problem. So we would get the wrong answer, and that we would get the wrong answer because we would be trying to read here R9 when the new value of R9 wasn't even computed yet. So it wasn't available yet, at least. So we'll talk about fixes for that in a future lecture. And indeed, it's going to be, we're going to have to add some circuitry and sometimes slow down our processor to do that. Does that answer your question? Yes? Question, if it was two apart with the same issue, it happens, yes, because remember that when we have 1700 here, it's not going to be written until after the next rising edge. But if it's two apart, that seems like easier to deal with, right? But three would be okay with this design, yes. But we'll have a solution, it turns out, as a preview, we'll have a solution that doesn't add extra delay, even if it's one apart. As far as cycles, doesn't add extra delay.